Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1122.MA0624, certificate number 24581, the Second Missouri Compromise.
That's a compromise?
Well, Linus, welcome to the show. What can you tell us about where you're calling from and give us a little bit of a bio for our listeners just so they can get acquainted with you as I am now so well acquainted with you?
Well, yeah. So my name is Linus Chan. I am from the great state of Minnesota. I'm currently living and residing in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I am also an immigration lawyer. I actually teach at the law school at the University of Minnesota, and I run a legal clinic that represents people who are held in detention by ICE.
Wow. So you're busy now.
Yeah. Unfortunately, or, you know, I think it's very strange because these are very weird times, difficult times. So in some ways, I'm very busy. But I like to think of it more as like I feel emotionally busy because unfortunately, one of the things that's happening is how much this administration likes to kick people out of court. So, yeah.
It's really curious how much lately I've realized that lawyers and state's attorneys general and like the whole class of political lawyer, they're really on the front lines of the resistance in a way that I never expected. I never expected to be celebrating the legal profession and feeling like when people come to me with like feeling hopeless, you know, because my dad was a lawyer, my uncles were all lawyers, like lawyers. I was surrounded by them. But when people come feeling hopeless, feeling despairing, what should we do? I always say, paraphrasing Mr. Rogers, I say, when times are tough, look for the lawyers. Like the lawyers are the ones who, at least for now, are the bulwark.
Yeah, it's very strange. You know, I went into law with the idea of being that generation that had, you know, grew up on the Gatorade of the civil rights movement, right? That pictured the civil rights era, pictured Thurgood Marshall and all of the ideas of that this is social change and the lawyers can help lead the way. And of course, the longer that I've been a lawyer, the more I realize that's just not true, right? That lawyers are important. And I think, you know, I very much am grateful for the fact that I've been able to do what I do. But, you know, as I think quite a few people that I respect and care about know, that it's the lawyers can only do so much, and it's really the people that will actually make the social change. So, for instance, you know, we read about people like Thurgood Marshall, and we read about the civil rights era and lawsuits and Brown versus Board of Education, but it's just as much the people who organized the marches, the people who organized those actions, the people who went out there and really kind of, you know, the John Lewis's, so to speak, of putting their bodies out there. And so this day and age, it feels very strange. I remember during the first Trump administration when people would find out what I do. And it was the first time, you know, when I first started doing this work, being an immigration lawyer, it was strange because no party liked us. You know, the Democrats were using the words illegal immigrant or illegal alien just as much as the Republicans. But during that first Trump administration, people would come up and they would say, like, oh, thank you for your service. And it was very odd. I that was the only time that I felt like I could relate to a serviceman who didn't know quite how to answer that question, right? Like, I thank you, but really no. Like, I, you know, it's a very strange situation. So
as an immigration lawyer, did you always focus on immigration situations where people were here and were trying to avoid being deported, rather than immigration lawyer who facilitates a rich Saudi moving to a high rise in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I always represented those who were detained, and I always did work in public interest. So I've had the absolute pleasure of never having to ask to get paid. I'm very lucky that way. There's a lot of people doing really, really lovely and amazing work, and I'm not disparaging that at all. But I've had the absolute freedom, so to speak, of not having to get paid for my work. But it does mean that I've also represented quite a few people that a lot of people would say, you know, are not well loved. And a lot of people would say don't belong in the United States. When I went to law school, which was the late 90s, the political issue of the day was the death penalty. So I really wanted to do death penalty work. I went to law school thinking that that's what I was going to do. And then I left law school doing deportation defense. And I like to think of that as, you know, I don't mind. One way to think of it is I don't mind falling in love with the sinners, which I really do. I really appreciate the people that I work with and get a chance to try to navigate this sort of crazy system that we have. So
Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Seattle, Washington have a lot in common socially, culturally. When you're in Minneapolis and St. Paul, even maybe more, you just feel, as a Seattleite, you go, oh, right, I get everything about this town, kind of more than almost any other place in the United States.
Absolutely. I feel like they're sister cities. And there's a lot of shared love of the outdoors, love of flannel, love of Subarus. I think there's a lot of shared cultural touchstones.
Replacements, Prince, we really are, you know, right together.
Exactly. Though, you know, Seattle's a bit warmer, so there is that. But otherwise, I think it's pretty close. Guys have some proximity to Canada, too. So I think
we do. We have a lot of Scandahoovians here. They're kind of, it's like a cresting wave. You have to keep them off, which I know is true there, too.
Yeah.
What is your own family's immigration story? Do you mind telling me the saga?
No, not at all. Actually, I'm trying to write this essay about that. So I've had a little bit of experience talking about it. So my parents both were refugees. My father was the family story goes is that he was born on a train as the family were fleeing the communists during the Chinese Civil War. So
you're kidding me. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So he, you know, born in 1946. My grandfather was a was in the Nationalist Army in the military. Mm-hmm. There was
Chiang Kai-shek.
Exactly. Was in this giant civil war, and the family had to flee, and then they eventually became refugees in Hong Kong. And so they lived, you know, it's hard to explain, but like Hong Kong went from a city of like several hundred thousand to over a million plus in less than like 3 or 4 years, right? It was a giant destination for the Chinese diaspora and refugees. My mother, my grandfather on my mother's side was a political prisoner, and he was, as soon as he got released from prison, he took his family and my grandmother, who was pregnant with my mother at the time, they also fled to Hong Kong. And so she was actually born in the British colony of Hong Kong. And then
he was a political prisoner under Mao, or he was a political prisoner under the Japanese?
Well, it's complicated, but essentially the communist takeover of the country at the time. So this is 40, this is 48. So right around that period. And both my parents came here for college. My dad went to a little tiny school in Virginia called Bridgewater College. And the story of, you know, these are family stories, so you never try to dig too deep. But the story was, is that he had a choice between going to Bridgewater or going to Berkeley. But Bridgewater actually gave him more money. And the name Bridgewater in Chinese sounded nicer.
Oh, right. Right. It was fortuitous.
Yeah. But of course, he was the only Chinese person within the entire county where he was out in Virginia. And then he came prior to Loving versus Virginia. So he had to actually, and he was told very clearly that he had to watch out for the women that he would keep company with, so to speak.
Oh, right, right, right. And did your parents, did growing up in Hong Kong, did they grow up speaking English?
Yes and no. My mother spoke more English. She went to a different schooling system in Hong Kong. And my father, they did learn a little bit of English, but his story was, you know, when he took the SATs, so to speak, he got a zero on the English and got, you know, 100% on the math. And this was before the TOEFL was in existence. So they had a different experience of learning English, but my father came to the United States, and his story is that he would learn English by watching Dobie Gillis and reading Peanuts cartoons, which is the origin of my name. And then my mother ended up going to college at Vassar. So, and then they met at Cornell. So,
wow, you're literally named after Linus Van Pelt.
Yeah, if my father's a scientist, he's a physicist. So he would tell his scientist friends I was named after Linus Pauling, but he would, the real story is that he picked the most, as in his words, the smartest Peanuts character that also happened to be the most neurotic and most insecure as well. So.
maybe the most like identifiable to a Chinese person culturally, like, ah, Linus, I get it.
Yes, maybe. Maybe.
Did your parents speak Chinese in the home? Did you grow up with a bilingual culture?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I did. In fact, one of the things that I write about because of the birthright citizenship stuff is both my parents were graduate students when they had me. And so under this Trump administration's executive order, I would not be a U.S. citizen. And I actually, my mother took me back to Hong Kong when I was quite young. And so I lived for a lot of some of those early years in Hong Kong and not actually speaking much English. And so I have a very distinct memory. So it's always interesting because this is usually an immigrant story, but I'm a citizen. But I remember when I first went to first day of school, I think it was first grade in the United States, and all the kids were running around and talking. And in my mind, I thought, they all sound like chickens. So to me, English sounded like a chicken language. But then very quickly, I forgot my Chinese within a couple of years. I do speak a little bit. I speak some Cantonese I used to speak more with my grandparents. But both of my parents, they ended up speaking English at home most of the time. Yeah. My parents got divorced when I was quite young. So,
wow, what a fascinating story. What a witness to history all of that is. You know, you think about now, a lot of those events are receding into a kind of the haze of our distant past. But it's always marvelous to see how many of us there are who can connect directly one or two generations away from these world epical events.
Yeah, I think so. And I have to say, you know, it is one reason that I so much enjoy the omnibus generally, and so much enjoy history and thinking about history, just because it is just like, I don't know, you get that little bit of pleasure in finding a connection that you never knew was there, or finding out a story and relating to some soul in the past and not realizing that, you know. I think it's all pretty, you know, I don't know, I sound very, but very neat. It's just very neat to get that kind of, you know, exposure to certain cool things. Doesn't have to mean big, giant meaning of life sort of things, but it can be still really, really interesting to hear and think about the connections with the past that we might have.
So when we start to address our topic today, you know, you hear a lot of sort of critique of the United States as a place that is that was founded on slavery and inequality. A lot of the founding documents, a lot of the prime events of American history are so intrinsically threaded, interwoven with racism and you know, systems of oppression, that the very foundation of the country is corrupted, and in some ways maybe irredeemable, and so the only solution to these systemic inequalities is to somehow, is to address it at its root cause in some ways by unraveling what we would think of as the foundational documents, or unraveling the history of the United States in a kind of lit crit way, that there isn't any appeal to American history and our past as an exemplar of a search for equality or freedom, because all of that stuff is tarnished by its time. So your topic today is really, we're talking about some of the core events of the middle 19th century and how America had this enormous identity crisis and what resulted from it, that now really applies to your daily work in a lot of ways, wouldn't you say?
That's exactly how I came up with it, right? When I was dating my wife, I'd been researching and writing something, and one of our first dates, I would start talking about this topic. And so it has long been a running joke of ours that the first thing I can do to basically get people to see whether or not I can hold their attention is if I can say the words second Missouri Compromise and they could actually still not be looking for the exit door and trying to figure out what I'm talking about.
Is this a thing you're recommending as a way to woo someone, like in a bar or at a trivia contest or something? Just see what her reaction is.
Absolutely. If it's something that you actually are interested in it, why not? Get them to see what it is, what your what are your joys, your passions, and if it's the all the more a little bit off the beaten path, that's another way, great example to see whether or not someone could be interested in what you're about. And I think what we're talking, right? So for a lot of this is the question that has come up in a lot of my work, which is, well, what does citizenship come with? What are the rights of citizenship? You know, one of the things that we like to talk about is sometimes the media, right? A lot of the times lately, the media will talk about, oh, look how horrible this policy is. It even causes citizens to get locked up and hurt or all of those things, which I understand completely. Of course, you know, it's a natural way that people can relate to the story. But it's always a weird thing for me when I hear that, because a lot of the things when you hear about, oh my goodness, this citizen was locked up for several hours, for several days or for weeks, or was mistreated by ICE and they're a citizen. My question is if they weren't a citizen, why is that okay? Why is that something that we would say citizens are this, then they get protected? And it kind of led a lot to when I was doing my work, I would be talking to people who would be facing deportation, which is, you know, something that the Supreme Court has said, you know, that which makes life worth living, right? The idea of being separated from your family, your community, and your home. So, yeah, I mean, it leads me to, like, start digging in. Like, well, what does it mean? Like, what are the rights to citizenship? You know, on a social level, it always, you know, whenever I make the claim that I'm a citizen, and I've had to do that several times, it means that I have every right to be here. I have every right to enjoy the fruits and bounties of this country and all of that. At the same time, you know, the Constitution, our Bill of Rights, famously uses the word person or people. It doesn't say the word citizen. And so what we're about to talk about, which is the Second Missouri Compromise, really does dive into one of the first questions on a constitutional, congressional level of what does citizenship get you? And so I always kind of like to start a lot of the conversations about when talking about non-citizens, which is to say, well, what is the difference? What is the protections that citizens get you? And so I think some of that is a bit of a surprise for people.
So I just had some house guests over, and they stayed for a week, 10 days, I think. And as part of being a generous host, I surrendered my bedroom, the master bedroom, to my guests. And as part of making up their bed, I put on my miracle-made sheets, and just to see kind of what their reaction would be. And right away, the next morning, my guests came out and said, "God, what great sheets!" And I said, "Let me tell you, my guest friend, about miracle-made sheets. The thing about miracle-made, because I have a bedroom, my master bedroom, I keep cold, partly because it's built on top of a bomb shelter. And so it's not that I keep it cold, it's that it's naturally cold, and I don't make a great effort to heat it up. But miracle-made sheets are temperature-regulating. So rather than stack the bed with 1,000 comforters, miracle-made sheets actually kind of work because they're silver-infused. They actually function kind of as a, well, as a temperature regulator, and they're actually warmer than they might seem at first blush because they're not super heavy. They're not flannel sheets. They have this feel that feels very luxurious, very silky. And as I was happy to tell my guests, the silver technology is antibacterial. They stay clean and fresh up to three times longer than regular sheets, which means fewer odors, fewer wash cycles, way less laundry. And my house guests couldn't have been more thrilled to discover that not only did I surrender my bedroom, but I gave them my premium sheets. And now, here's your chance to get those same premium sheets. I love saying premium sheets. Upgrade your sleep by going to trymiracle.com/omnibus to try Miracle-Made sheets today and save over 40% when you use the promo code Omnibus. Then you'll get an extra 20% off of that, plus a free three-piece towel set. These also make an amazing gift. A lot of birthdays coming up in the spring, as we know. And they come with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So go to trymiracle.com/omnibus and enter the code Omnibus at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. A lot of this is kind of tied up with the idea of human rights, of universal human rights, which was a fairly new concept or even a nascent concept when the country was being formed. And that idea, the idea of human rights as a political status or as a innate status, has evolved along with the country. And there is quite a bit of language in the founding documents that's aware of this and kind of dances around it or lays the groundwork. Nobody really wanted to plenty of people wanted to plant a flag, but how does the concept of universal human rights come into conflict with the idea of citizenship as a membership or citizenship as something that is more exclusive and has conditions?
Yeah. So this is great because as you talk about, right, the Declaration of Independence was used as the framework for the French Revolution, which itself becomes later on the framework of creating this idea of natural rights, positive rights, the idea that, you know, our rights are not dependent on just the king who can give them. If the king violates our natural rights, that became the rallying cry for the Declaration of Independence. Now, there were several different things that were talked about in the demands that the colonists made, which I will get to. But I think one of the really interesting questions that comes up is, well, rights, what does that mean? How are we supposed to talk about them? Who decides what they are, right? Famously, when there were the founders were debating the Constitutional Convention, the Bill of Rights was not something that was put into the original Constitution. Many of the founders thought that the structure of the Constitution was enough. Many others thought that it was the states that should be protecting rights rather than having it spelled out in a national document.
And what would that have looked like if they had settled on the rights being determined and protected by the individual states? Like what would have been the argument for that, and how much would the states have differed? And I'm not talking about within the context of slavery, but just generally.
Well, I mean, it would be that if people would basically have their rights protected by their state government, and it's their state government that would be the ones that necessarily would enforce those rights. But that led to, you know, one of the challenges was the Articles of Confederation, which was the founding document before the Constitution, essentially had that model. It essentially had the model where every state was its own state. There was a sense of national unity, but not really a national government. And that's where the language that became so problematic that creates the crisis of the Second Missouri Compromise actually comes from. It comes from the Articles of Confederation. And it is what would later on be put into the Constitution as Article 4, and it's the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the Constitution. And the Privileges and Immunities Clause essentially is written in such a way, the Articles of Confederation actually spell out some of those quote-unquote Privileges and Immunities Clause, immunities a little bit more explicitly, but the language that was settled upon by the framers of the Constitution was not very clear on exactly what language. And a lot of historians and scholars argue it's because they were relying on states, that these were the rights that were created by, decided upon by states. And what it essentially said is, hey, if you're a Virginian and you happen to go to New York, you cannot be treated differently than if you were a New York citizen. And so the idea would be, it, you know, one of the first formulations, though, was it didn't require every state to recognize the same rights. It just required you, Virginia, to treat anyone that's visiting your state from another of the states to treat them as if you would treat them your own residents. And so that becomes what would be, right, what would be the model that you would say of a state-centered source of rights. But that becomes in conflict with what would later become the federal Constitution and then would really come into conflict later on and becomes the natural debate that really frames much of the 19th century until the Civil War.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, this is still a major question, ongoing question. If you are in a same-sex marriage in California and you visit a state where same-sex marriage isn't recognized, are you being treated as you would be in your own state, or are you being treated as a member, as you would be as a resident of that state?
Yeah, I think Governor Abbott, right, has said that he will not allow New Yorkers, people from New York City, because of Mamdani's election, won't allow them to come into the state of Texas. Well, the framers would certainly have said that's no bueno. That can't be allowed.
Take us through the Missouri Compromise before we talk about the second Missouri Compromise.
Yes. So, 1819, Missouri is one of the first territories that goes ahead and applies for statehood.
And this is the first state across the Mississippi other than Louisiana to try and be a part of the United States.
Yeah, they get together, they decide they want to. And it's important, I think, some of the context, too, that it gets lost. I think you would appreciate this being a military history. This is a period where post War of 1812, the era of good feelings, James Monroe is president, and he has dominated the number of electoral college votes in a way that no one has seen before, right? And or since.
Right. He's got a real mandate.
Yeah. And the Federalist, which was, the other party, so to speak, if you were a Hamilton musical fan, that's the party of Hamilton, was by this point, because of their opposition to the War of 1812, essentially becomes almost a non-existent party by this point in time. At the same time, Ironically, they're one of the first debates of the 15th Congress was about tariffs. And it was a sectional question about tariffs. The North, which were industrial states, wanted to apply tariffs because they wanted to protect their industry.
Sure. Keep that British textile stuff out of this country.
Exactly. And the South, of course, they were big exporters. They don't want tariffs. And at the time, right, the North had more representatives because they were based on population. And, you know, they had a lot more control over the House. But the South, because we're still living with that original compromise between states, the Senate was much of a tougher call. Right. So when Missouri goes ahead and applies for statehood, a representative from the great state of New York, Talmadge, says, you know what? We should condition the entry of Missouri on them abolishing slavery. What's interesting is that his Talmadge amendment wasn't saying they cannot enter as a slave state, but that they, if they wanted to become a state, they had to eventually free their slaves.
And how much of this kick the can down the road, we're going to abolish slavery, but not today? How much of that was, because we think about the Southern states as being adamantly trying to defend slavery as an institution and the Northern states all having eliminated it. But there was actually quite a bit of, we're all, you know, like, what we want is not to eliminate it today exactly. That seems like a big job, but we want people to like sign off on it.
Yeah, this is one of the things, right? People who are Thomas Jefferson fans will argue this till the cows come home. Like, were these folks who are these pillars of American history, were they actually against slavery, not against slavery? Because many people, what they sought to basically say is we should let slavery die on its own. You know, we ended the slave trade, right? That was one of the first things that got passed after the original compromise, the 1803. They ended the migration clause. They ended international trade of slaves. And the question then became, a lot of people, including, you know, some writings from Thomas Jefferson, though other writings seem to say other things, but some writings of Thomas Jefferson essentially saying, you know what? Slavery will die and it will die on its own. And so many people thought that we could prevent a more sectional crisis, prevent this idea of the South and this imbalance of political power. And what's important, you know, is a lot of the people in the North were not so much, they were anti-slaves, but they were more also looking at it from a political prism. They looked at the fact that the slave states were able to count 3/5 of their slaves as part of the census, and they were able to use that power with the Senate in a way that prevented the more populous North from being able to do its thing.
Because they could front load the House, and then this is an issue that we are talking about all the time now, which is the construction of the Senate giving all this tremendous weight to states like South Dakota that have, you know, almost no population, or Wyoming, just in general, as a lawyer, maybe not as an immigration lawyer, but as an American with an interest in the way the country is built, do you feel like this, like the United States Senate, our House of Lords, permanently dooms our Congress to be to privilege territory over population? And is that something that makes the whole American system kind of unwieldy?
I mean, I think it is hard not to come to the conclusion that it violates the general principles of democracy, right? especially when you also feed into it this idea of the filibuster. In my opinion, the irrelevance of Congress.
Go on.
The irrelevance of Congress has sort of led us to where we're at, where people just don't expect anything good that can come out of Congress. People who are in Congress feel very much like their incentives are not to do anything good. And you have a situation that is, you know, really creating a place where no one thinks our government can work. And if once you have that, then it's kind of ripe for someone to come along and say, I can fix everything and I will do everything. And just let those bums get out of the way. And that's exactly what we're seeing. I think there's a lot to it. I think what's strange is that we capped the number of congressional representatives in the 1970s, which I think was a big mistake, because now it's created more and more distance between the congressperson and the average Joe, so to speak. Like I am very active in my local sphere, but I have very rarely met the person that represents me in Congress. And I don't think that is the system that either the founders or people who really believe in representational democracy would think is healthy, right?
Right.
I absolutely. And, ironically, this was a problem from the beginning. This wasn't a situation where like only now after, 200 some odd years do we go, oh, this is an issue. No, it was a problem. And it was a problem. And a lot of it was, as you point out, was one of the first compromises, which was the compromises between the southern slaveholding states and the states that did not have slaves. This idea of the three-fifths compromise was this kind of weird aspect of trying to count people but not allow them to be counted as people, right?
Right.
And so that becomes a problem. And in this era, right, and it would become much more so by the time you get to the 18, by the time you have right on the heels of the Civil War, the issue was they would be calling it the slave power. It wasn't the institution necessarily. Of course, there were people who were very much against the institution, but a lot of the political perspective was about the power that was aggregating in these aristocratic kind of feudalistic almost systems that started to butt heads against this northern industrial wanting to be progressive and cosmopolitan and really trying to do all those things. And that became a cultural clash.
So you mentioned Thomas Jefferson, this, depending on who you ask, heroic or controversial or both figure in American history. And he was still alive at this
and he
time
had a big role. Yeah, he had a had very a big role with the Missouri Compromise.
Yeah, and he recognized that this was, didn't he say something to the effect that they were drawing lines that were going to rent the country asunder soon enough, like one day?
He actually used the word the death knell of the Union. And
wow.
So obviously you have the New York representative essentially saying, let's ban slavery. Let's no longer allow slavery. And there was a giant debate, right? The Northwest Territories, which were this great state that I happen to be residing in, was
That's
created
right.
out of, did not have slavery. And there was this question, right, of where were the lines of slavery? And the Missouri Compromise did one of many things, and it's something that Thomas Jefferson actually noted, which was, it created essentially a North-South divide, because what ended up happening was after Talmadge wrote this amendment that passed the House, the Senate came back and said, no, we're not going to accept that.
Was this the power of the Southern states expressed in the Senate to say like this, this sets a precedent that is not going to work for us.
Yes. And Thomas Jefferson at the time was, you know, James Monroe basically recruited quite a few people. And this is, by the way, you know, reading through this, there's a lot of discussion about whether the Masons actually played a role in the Missouri Compromise.
So now you're talking about the aliens that live under the ice cap who've been running American politics.
Yeah, I mean, by 1830s was the creation of the anti-Mason political party. And so there was already quite a few of these people were Masons. There were the senators from New York, and Henry Clay himself was considered a Mason. The vice president becomes the Grand Poobah of New York, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But one of the people that Monroe recruited to try to figure out what to do about this debate, right? You know, Missouri wants to be a state. Then, you know, they want to use that as a way to start banning slavery. The House says yes. The Senate says no. And then Thomas Jefferson starts coming around, and he starts essentially writing in the same way. It's like, it is so sad that the sacrifices of my generation are going to be essentially wasted on the sons of this generation, right? Basically saying, this is going to be the only reason they're putting this amendment into this. The only reason they want to get rid of slavery has nothing to do with slavery. It has everything to do with killing the Union. And that's a lot of the argument at the time, was this was a cynical ploy for power.
On the part of the North, the idea not being that the South would secede, but that the North would exclude the South or expel it.
Yeah, in fact, they even had boogeymen, just like they do now, Donnie from New York City. And back then, Rufus King was one of the boogeymen that was talked about during this period of time. And so what ended up happening is the Senate comes back and says, no, Henry Clay, suddenly Maine comes around and also applies for statehood. And so, and this is how Henry Clay gets the sort of reputation of being the great compromiser. And he basically sees this as a way in, that, hey, if Maine wants to be a state and they want to be a free state, and Missouri wants to be a state, maybe we can start talking, right? Maybe we can figure out something that would be acceptable.
And what are the relative populations and economies of Maine and Missouri? Because Maine even now has an economy based almost entirely on collecting waves, I think, right? Don't they just like bottle waves?
Yeah.
And the population of Maine is largely moose, which are bigger than you think. But Missouri would have been potentially an agricultural.
It was a booming, like it was, you know, the gateway to the West. You know, I spent a little bit of time in Missouri and St. Louis, and it was the kind of viewed as like the future of the country, right? This is before, of course, the American-Mexican War, which caused a lot more territory to be opened up in the West. But at this point in time, Missouri was the frontier. It was the area that was going to become the big. And Maine, you know, was part of Massachusetts. It was a smaller part of Massachusetts. It was not its own territory that we were talking about at the same time.
Oh, French too. Ugh. God.
And so there was, in fact, a census that happened right afterwards. And I think the census found, you know, the population differences were quite large between Missouri and Maine. So, you know, I think it is clear that these were, you know, the savvy workers had a lot to do. The savvy compromiser just also had a lot where Monroe, remember, he was been elected in a giant landslide. It was super popular. And even though there were sectional differences with the Republicans or the Democratic Republicans at the time, which was the dominant party, there really hadn't split totally. And so because Thomas Jefferson was the founder of their party and he was talking to people who were on in the North and saying, this is a threat to our Union. Don't let them fool you. That's when the compromises got set, essentially, which was the idea, and it had to go through the House. And this is when Henry Clay was, worked the members as much as possible. And they finally did a compromise that was, interestingly enough, the compromise was, all the territories below this line, no territories above that line. And interestingly, it wasn't that Missouri could enter as a slave state, is that the question about whether Missouri would enter as a slave state would be Missouri's question to answer. And one of the things that was talked about, there was some people have argued that there, one of the reasons why this compromise got passed in the House that was so initially against it was the idea that maybe the local election would go for the side of the anti-slaves or the restrictionists. Maybe there would be this sweep of anti-slave sentiment that would carry Missouri and they would themselves not want to be a slave state.
And was there a large and vocal movement of abolitionists in Missouri?
They might have been loud, and they were definitely there, but they certainly were not large enough.
I see.
In fact, there was a Missouri, after the Congress passes the law that allows Missouri, this first compromise, Missouri goes ahead and they have a referendum, and the slave-owning Missourians do quite well, right? Do really well. And there's a discussion about one newspaper man who was pro-slavery, wasn't satisfied with just winning that, but ended up beating the crap out of another. Not content with beating anti-slavery advocates of the poll, Isaac Henry, who was... Isaac Henry was an anti-slave advocate. Thomas Hart was a co-editor at the pro-slavery St. Louis Inquirer, physically assaulted the editor of the rival anti-slavery Gazette right after the vote, right?
This was the caning of Charles Sumner era, when it was still possible in the United States to take to the Senate floor and just beat the shit out of somebody.
Yeah, well, that's a crazy story too. But yes, essentially this idea was... And what ended up happening is the how much Missouri went for having slaves shocked the House of Representatives.
Right.
And what they did was they wrote in their Constitution, not only would they allow slavery, but they, one, banned any law that would free slaves. So this was new.
This was unprecedented in American states.
Yeah. In fact, even South Carolina and other states, they had freed slaves in those states at this time. But they wrote into the Missouri Constitution, which they had presented to Congress, any law cannot be allowed to grant freedom to slaves. And then the second one, which becomes the key one, which is a saying, and no blacks or mulattoes, freed or not, are allowed into, well, no freed former slaves, blacks or mulattoes, are allowed into the state of Missouri.
Whoa, major escalation.
Exactly. So that becomes... It's strange, right? Because in one way, you would say, oh, well, the fight was about slavery. But it was this last part that caused the people in the House of Representatives to rally again. And basically, they say, we cannot allow Missouri to have that constitution. That would violate the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
And the argument being that... Massachusetts, a lot of the northern states, we have given citizenship to free blacks, and the privileges and immunity or immunities clause allows for what's called the right to travel, right? Allowing people to come into. So even though Greg Abbott can talk all he wants about not allowing New Yorkers, he certainly could not do that to citizens of the great state of New York, who also happen to be U.S. citizens, because of the language of Article 4 of the Constitution.
And Missouri being at this point, Missouri is now the choke point for immigration to the entire American West, right? St. Mm-hmm. Louis is the gateway. So to exclude blacks from, or freed blacks from Missouri is to, and also up the big river, is to effectively close the gate for black immigration to the West.
Well, and, you know, there's a wonderful book by Martha Jones called Birthright Citizenship, which is looks at the antebellum period right before the Civil War in Baltimore. And, you know, what becomes increasingly true is that slave states start to really get more and more paranoid about non-slaves blacks. And they get more and more worried about slave revolts. When Haiti did their big slave revolt, it caused a huge amount of consternation around all the slave states. They're like, oh my God, if we just let people walk around, maybe they'll start saying to each other that they should be free, and then there will be slave revolts, and then, you know, we can count, and the number of slaves versus the number of owners is probably not in our favor. Right. And that becomes a big aspect. So Missouri takes it to the extreme. At this point, there were Southern members of both Virginia and South Carolina who had considered similar provisions in their constitutions but had abandoned them because they thought they would violate the U.S. Constitution.
They didn't think they wouldn't dare.
And in fact, there were former slaves who were freed in some of these slaveholding states that were given, you know, the ability to vote. At one point, these former slaves were able to vote in a way that they were not exercising the right to vote in states like Pennsylvania or other northern states because of the bias generally against black people and discrimination that they would face, even though they technically could vote.
Right.
So this becomes a choke point, as mentioned. The House of Representatives passes a bill that basically says Missouri cannot prevent the people who are citizens of other states from entering their great state.
So as I've mentioned before, I've actually started kind of wearing my hair slightly differently, not to conceal the fact that I feel like it's thinning, but to prepare the world for a time when my hair has thinned enough that I will be wearing it differently as, not a concealment exactly, but as a new style, wearing my hair in a style that supports my thinning hair, but I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. And one thing about being a performer that goes on stage, from the standpoint of the audience, oftentimes you'll notice someone who does not appear to be balding when you see them on the floor in regular life, but with those lights behind them, all of a sudden you see the halo glow of the top of their scalp, and their hair kind of appears to be just a wispy sort of cotton candy on top. It's really terrible, and I really hope that it hasn't happened to me yet. And so I am absolutely the target market for treatments that would actually, you know, not just prevent hair loss, but actually hopefully promote hair regrowth. And that's why I am recommending to you and to myself Hims. Hims makes it simple to feel like yourself again, which is what I'm looking to do. I'm hoping to live for 900 years, but Hims is not offering that service yet. But Hims does offer access to simple, personalized care that fits your life and mine and our hair goals. Hims offers access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including finasteride, minoxidil. It comes in chews, in oral medications, in serums and sprays, and it helps not only stop further hair loss, but regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. There are no hidden fees, no surprise costs, just real personalized care on your schedule. So for simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, for erectile dysfunction, and for weight loss and more, visit hims.com/omnibus. That's hims.com/omnibus for your free online visit. hims.com/omnibus. Now, featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription is required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride.
And this enters the figure of Charles Pinckney, who is, if you wanted a villain in this story, I think he makes a pretty good villain.
So, and we're still in 1819 at this point in the story, right?
This is 1821. So 1820 was the Missouri Compromise. And then Missouri comes up with their constitution. It goes back to debate. And it's interesting because by now, 1821, it's actually a new Congress from 1820. And in between that 1 year, there was a tremendous backlash against the Northerners, both the senators who voted for the Missouri Compromise, and, senators who voted for it, and the House of Representatives who voted. Many people, the legislatures, voted to recall them. Remember, because legislators were the ones who were That's right. Voting for senators, recalled them and basically kicked them out of office afterwards. And this is also where the term doughface comes from. So,
the term we all use all the time,
doughface. I just think it's a nice, interesting term because it was from dough as in deer dough to then gets changed into dough as in doughy. And really was a way to talk about Northerners who voted for Southern principles, traitors, which I think it would be really interesting to see about the 7 Democratic senators, about whether or not they would be called dough-faced senators at this day and age. But that was essentially the big insult, is that you have Northern folks who are voting against their own interests. They were already looked upon as somewhat traitors when the tariff vote failed. And so now you have a whole bunch of people really angry about the Missouri Compromise. So the new Congress comes in, the new argument comes up, says, hey, Missouri is trying to violate the U.S. Constitution, is trying to exclude U.S. citizens. Again, right, we're using citizens as the hallmark of who we're trying to protect. We're not trying to protect the poor slaves anymore. We're not talking about people who are slaves. No debate that slaves are citizens. So now
we're talking about the citizenship of free blacks in the North. A free black from New York City should be able to go to St. Louis without impediment.
Exactly.
And that is the argument.
Yes. And that was a very strong, you know, roots of that clause was there from the beginning. Articles of Confederation used the language that all free inhabitants will have the right to free ingress and egress into any and all of the states. Right. By the time the Constitution came around, they took out that exact wording, but it was understood that that's what it meant. The right to travel was supposed to be, you know, part of what made, and this is what you know, in the Federalist Papers, they were arguing this for Hamilton, and then later in even Madison were arguing that's what made our country our country, is that people can be treated a certain way, and the right to travel in between the different states, that becomes a fundamental part of what's called privileges and immunities.
Now, as a legal scholar, this may be a little bit of arcana, but if I were Justice Scalia and claiming to be a constitutional originalist, would I, as an originalist, be considering the Articles of Confederation as part of this originalism, or would I be specifically looking at the language of the Constitution and making determinations? And when this ambiguity was present, if people at the time would have assumed the Articles of Confederation were applicable, but that isn't actually in the language of the Constitution, is that part of where the dispute was there traction there?
This is great to talk about originalism, because that's exactly what ends up happening with Charles Pinckney. Because Charles Pinckney happened to be one of the people who also was a person who was at the Constitutional Convention.
Oh, now, wow.
Now, when you talked about Scalia, Scalia actually talks about originalism in a slightly different way. Scalia talks about originalism as what was the common understanding at that time.
Oh,
I see. It wasn't necessarily about what the person who actually wrote. But there has been, since then, quite a bit of looking at this question about what did the framers mean, and how did they talk about it, and how did they consider the Articles of Confederation into the Privileges and Immunity, or Privileges and Immunities Clause. And there is, of course, people will argue and debate this, but there's quite a bit of evidence that even if there were certain disagreements, and there was one disagreement that was clear, because, and Madison talked about this, Articles of Confederation said anyone that were free inhabitants of a state gets to be treated as if they were citizen of the receiving state. Uh-huh. And the question is, and Madison's like, why are we doing that? We're allowing, and this was, you know, something that was a complaint, where you have, let's say, Pennsylvania allowing all of those Germans into the great state of Pennsylvania. And now as Virginians, we have to treat all those Germans as if they were citizens of Virginia. And Madison talked about this was a good change from the Articles of Confederation, that it's really about citizens and only citizens and whatnot. There's an argument that it was about because for the first time, the Constitution gave the power to create citizens to Congress and not as something that is just for the individual states to do so.
Yeah.
So, yes. There was this debate, and during this debate about the Second Missouri Compromise, that's exactly the card that Charles Pinckney tries to show. And his argument was, hey, I was the one that wrote Article 4.
Talk about an originalist.
Yeah, he's like, I drafted it. I proposed this article. In a speech in 1821, he goes, yeah, remember my work 40 years ago? That was me. And when I wrote it, nobody thought black people could be citizens. Let's stop with that nonsense right here and now. And his speech is a sort of master class of all of the awful arguments that would later become used all over the place. When Justice Taney writes the Dred Scott decision, he refers back to Charles Pinckney. He talks about how no one thought that African Americans could be citizens. Never mind, and this was, you know, one of the difficulties that everyone had in this argument were, of course, that a lot of these northern states, even at the time of the founding, had people voting. right? You had free slaves voting, formerly slaves, or people who were never slaves, right? There were quite a few people in the colonies who were black but would never spend time as a slave, either because they were born into freedom or other situations.
And how much was Pinckney overstating his influence, overstating his position as a founder?
He was definitely a founder.
Yeah.
But and historians have looked back at this article and basically say there's no evidence that he was the one that wrote it. There is evidence that he wanted to include into Article 4 more language protecting slaves and slave owners. Because one of the questions about Article 4 and what happens when a visitor from one state goes to another is a question that would become a giant flashpoint during the antebellum period, which is, does the receiving state have to recognize the rights that you have that you came with? So if I am the slave, right? This is the whole issue with Dred Scott. When the army officer brought Dred Scott to our great state of Minnesota, Fort Snelling, he was in the territories that did not allow slavery. Does he still have that property right? Or does Dred Scott have the right to say, slavery is not allowed, I'm free, right? That was a lot of the arguments. And in fact, what was really interesting at the time is that it was Missouri courts that had started to recognize that those people should be freed. There was several cases before Dred Scott where a Missouri state court said, you know what? You're right. You, Mr. Slave, were in a free state, and therefore you should no longer be considered a slave.
Because they're making the reciprocal argument that if you are a free black from New York and you come to Missouri, you lose that freedom.
In certain situations, yes. I mean, that was the question, right? How do you treat that property right? So that was what Charles Pinckney was arguing for during the Constitutional Convention, is he wanted more protection for slave owners. So he has been extraordinarily consistent with what he says he wants. Later on, of course, there's been quite a bit of, you know, trying to parse out the language and what's going on and the historical drafts. But what was pretty clear is that it was heavily influenced, that there was not a lot of debate precisely because of the language that they basically took from Articles of Confederation. And so there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, back and forth and arguments about what the privileges and immunities clause mean and how to deal with that. Everyone sort of looked at it as you can't treat citizens of one state differently than the people in your own state. And it wasn't a source of positive rights for a long time. That changes by the time you get to 1823 in a case with oyster farmers. But in this particular situation, Pinckney goes up, says, and he has to deal with the fact that northern states gave the right to vote. But basically, he makes the argument that isn't that a terrible thing, that these poor people are forced to go and vote, and isn't that an awful thing for the voting aspect? Really, you know, the argument being that the franchise is made lesser for it than because of the participants of this, you know, of these African Americans.
Right. Still believing that the voters should be confined to property owners and, members of the ruling class.
Yeah. And he also, you know, goes and discusses about the wonders of slave ownership and how it, you know, is good for slaves, and talks and does all of those awful arguments that you have heard from the past. And unfortunately, we're still hearing these days about you know, why racial hierarchies should exist, or why, you know, white supremacy is the foundation of our country.
Right.
But it wasn't unopposed. What's really interesting, too, is like, yes, he was making these arguments, but there were other people making other arguments. People would argue about what it meant to be a citizen. Remember, at this point in time, the definition of a U.S. citizen wasn't really clear, and it wouldn't become clear. You know, the 14th Amendment is something that didn't come about until after the Civil War. So we have another 40-some years before we would decide what the constitutional meaning of citizenship was. And so there were people talking about, are citizens, they're citizens because they have certain rights? That was one way to think about it. Or do we give rights to only citizens, right? So that was one of the arguments that was happening during this period of time.
Now, does the second Missouri Compromise come about before or after the Kansas-Nebraska Act? I know that becoming
Way before. Kansas-Nebraska Act was coming off of the heels of, you know, that was right before the sectional crisis that would end up to be the Civil War, right? What's interesting is that the period of time from this, which is the 1821, until then, you had a kind of quietness about slavery. And the argument was that some historians have made is it was precisely because they created a regional line. Because before, there were Southerners that were fighting, like actively fighting slavery. But one of the things about the Missouri conflict is that many of the Southerners who hated slavery, who would later die saying, you know, in writing in their will, not only did they flee their own slaves, but would write that they would, you know, do everything in their power until my dying breath to get rid of slavery. Many of them defended the Southern states' ability to have slavery, because in their mind, the question wasn't about the institution of slavery. It was about the political prism of which they're looking at things.
Right. And we often talk about states' rights. Well, we only talk about the argument of states' rights, or until recently, in this very condescending way, because it's such a, or it was such a predominant argument or a euphemism, I guess, for the Civil War. Now we're seeing, again, the rise of a kind of states' rights argument, particularly in terms of northern states, you know, in a lot of ways, absolving themselves of the Trump administration's, you know, attempts to expand the federal rights and privileges and retain those for the state of Washington and Oregon and California, right? They're kind of
now we are, you know, yeah, the blue states are now states' rights, right?
Like, right, that's right.
You know, we have the argument that Governor, that Governor Pritzker is essentially making is you bring your national troops here, you're invading our state, right? Which is the same thing, right? That the, you know, Oregon and Portland and California are all talking about. At the same time, you know, it wasn't that long ago where we fought a civil war with the whole idea of establishing a more muscular national government and seeing where that lays us. But I just want to emphasize that once we drew that line, the Missouri line, the 36-30 line, we drew that line, the argument has been that many people basically started to view slavery as just a regional question. And so it really wasn't until after the U.S.-Mexico War and you suddenly opened up all of this new territory.
Right.
Right? This is how the Texans, when they came in, right? One of the things, And Jefferson even talks about this. He talks about, like, what's going to happen with the Spanish treaty and Florida, whether Florida is going to become another growing ground for slavery, and Cuba and all of these other places were looked upon as growth areas for the domestic slaves. At the same time, that's when you started to say, you know what, this is not going away. You had, you know, the Fugitive Slave Clause and how it was enforced, or the Fugitive Slave Act being more and more where, again, you had northern states saying our rights as a state are being violated because you are coming into our state, capturing people where slavery is illegal, and you're capturing these slaves and bringing them out. And in, you know, similarly, there are a lot of stories about how people were never slaves and they were being caught and being forced in there. So it becomes an area where it went from this quiet regional conflict because of the Missouri Compromise, but it would later be kind of ignited again when we created more territory and the question of what does this mean for individual, you know, for the power balance of Congress. And by then, the Republicans, the Free Soilers, all of that, the political parties have reformed. So there wasn't the dominant party that we had under James Monroe.
Was the Underground Railroad kind of posited as a counter argument to the Fugitive Slave Act? I mean, was that effort to provide a conduit for escaping slaves kind of viewed as equivalent to, you know, like mercenaries going into freed states and taking free blacks back?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much, and you know, I certainly don't view myself as an expert at all. But a lot of what I find in my work is that there is this really similar reaction about, for me, you know, what I find, I don't want to say interesting, but what I see as an echo is the way that a lot of undocumented folks are being treated as if they were fugitives, right? The idea that we can hunt them down to the end of the earth. We can grab them when they are at a courthouse. We can grab people when they are going to work or going to volleyball practice.
Picking up their kids at school.
Exactly. We can grab them because they are fugitives. Well, of course, in most of the way we're thinking, they're not fugitives. But the fugitive, the way that it was, and what would happen is these very high profile examples where they would come in and grab, and then the national government was in fact supporting the slave states with a national, where the federal government starts to go into these northern states to then demand and capture these people. That causes huge outrage. And yes, sure. Remember, most of the Underground Railroad, they were not freeing them in the northern states precisely because of the fugitive slave laws. They were going to Canada, right? They were literally, the path to freedom was through our northern neighbor and not within the states because of the fugitive slave laws that would mean that people were never quite protected. You know,
Geographically, how did the 3630 line line up with the Mason-Dixon line, which I know is based on a different?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't know. I would have to take a look.
I mean, it ends up being effectively the same division, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I think obviously that line becomes
a little fuzzy there in West Virginia, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's interesting to me is that Delaware was a slave state, you know, Tennessee was a slave state, but then also fought on the side of the Union. And so the slave or non-slave was, again, almost, there was this, the Confederates were also just a bit slightly different. So I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, the Mason-Dixon line was, I think, more, was considered this boundary. And so the Missouri Compromise line, which was more on the territorial side, right? Right. That becomes the precursor to the regionalism that would then become the divide of that would lead to the Civil War. So,
well, this has been a great history lesson. And, you know, I think that it's the kind of thing that so many of these terms and so many of these moments in American history, we know the big blocks, we know the big events where we can picture the sort of lead up, the antebellum period, as you're saying. We spend a lot of time there, but it's so clear that that things are set in motion, and they come into focus already happening, as though they were somehow fated or the product of the kind of inevitability or the great man theory or whatever. But you see in conversations like this the incrementalism and the points along the way where, I mean, this is the thing about politics. It's all compromise when it's effective, right? But Congress is only effective when compromise is part of their, what they consider their duty, rather than each congressman being this intractable stalwart of some tiny little ideology that they think they represent.
Well, I want to revisit what you first talked about at the beginning, which was this idea of, the United States being irredeemable. You know, one of the famous abolitionists would say, the Constitution is a death pact, right? And referring to slavery. At the same time, I think when I look back, I can't help but just notice that at every step of the way, there were people that were trying very hard, that were saying that, no, this is not right, that this is something that we cannot allow. This is not, there were disagreements about how they would do it. People who would want colonization and sending people to Liberia, or there were compromises about whether or not we would just, restrict its spread. But there were always people that were constantly fighting. And I think one of the biggest things about this conversation and thinking about that is two things. Because when the Second Missouri Compromise happened, what the compromise was essentially, you had the South saying Black people weren't citizens. You had the North saying, yes, they are. You can't restrict them. And the compromise was just saying, you know what? When Missouri don't pass a law that violates Article 4, it abandoned saying you cannot prevent Black people from coming into your state. So, of course, what did Missouri do? They passed laws that prevented people from going to the state. And the North sort of looked away because they weren't going to, they thought that this was a fight that was not going to happen. But I still go back to this question of there is always, and there is constantly, what we just saw with the government shutdown and what we're just seeing about politics now, right, is this issue of, well, when do we compromise and when can we not compromise? Because I think it is natural to not want conflict. But it's also, a lot of people would say that the Missouri, that compromise and the compromise that created the Constitution and whatnot created a path in which we had to fight a civil war. And so it is a really, and I don't pretend to know, right? I don't know what that line is, but it is something that makes me think about, yes, compromise is obviously can be the only way that certain things can get done. But there also has to be a question of at what point You know, where, what is it, and how do we make that calculus about what are the things that we can't compromise on? Because I think the lesson of the Missouri Compromise is that it created all of these ways for us to fight about it later. It was kicking the can down the road, and it was not a compromise that left either side happy, and it was not a kind of compromise that left either side thinking that it would fix anything.
Right.
And so, you know, it Kansas-Nebraska Act, that, you know, comes about. And then when Dred Scott comes around and the Supreme Court says, nope, the Missouri Compromise itself is unconstitutional.
Right.
That sets off
the powder keg.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of us feel like now is the time to draw the line on a lot of things, right? There's no question that in many of the things happening in American political life now, there isn't a middle ground because one side of it is just outrageously in violation of our first principles. And so I think there was over the last decade a lot of sort of like, well, you know, I see what they're saying kind of about this and that. And in one way, I'm grateful that the people on the other side of what we used to call the aisle have done such a comically botched job of not even arguing their case, but just sort of like, you know, like so exaggeratedly violating our founding ideas and all of our institutions that I think it's not a great leap for most of us now to say, well, this is the line and really like this is where we have to make a stand. There's no kicking the can down the road about federal power or presidential power now. It's we have to dig the trenches. So
yeah, if nothing else, you know, one of the interesting aspects is during that period of time, it was Congress flexing its power.
Right, and Congress has no interest in that now.
Yeah, and that's
just a wet noodle.
That's a big, if nothing else, that's a big tragedy. And you're right. I think we are coming up upon the question of, what are things that we are not willing to compromise on? What are the things that we, which is not to say that you ever give up the issue of trying to persuade, right? I think there's a challenge here of saying like, not compromising does not mean not trying to talk or discuss or persuade, right?
Right, absolutely.
It's never that.
It's the opposite.
But that doesn't mean it is necessarily what, you know, what happens when only one side wants to govern. So,
well, Linus, I can tell that your cat is mad at you and has had enough of the Second Missouri Compromise. But I want to just take this opportunity to thank you for your service. And and I really appreciate you coming on the Omnibus. This has been a great episode. Thank you so much.
Well, John, it's absolutely my pleasure. And, you know, getting a chance to meet and talk with you and a chance to quote unquote nerd out is something that I will appreciate for quite some time. And I'm thankful that I got a chance to do this with you. And, you know, I will at any time, at any place, I'd love to at some point have more discussions. But thank you so much for giving me this chance.
I'd enjoy that too. And now that you're entered into the Omnibus, you know, you're going to be a celebrity among futurelings. So get ready for your inbox to flood with what I can only imagine are memes that you never even knew existed before. So
I'll be looking forward to it. I'm sure I'm also going to get told exactly where I was wrong, what information I got incorrect. And all I can say is, well, too bad, so sad. All right.
Yeah, that's right. We'll deal with that on the Addenda show. So.
All right. Thank you.
And that concludes the Second Missouri Compromise, entry 1122.MA0624, certificate number 24581 in the Omnibus. Futurelings, I don't have to tell you, social media is an unholy trash fire, and we disavow it. Yet, we contribute to Facebook and Instagram at Omnibus Project. Fans of the show congregate on Reddit, Discord, and Facebook, and elsewhere under the group sobriquet Futurelings. And you can find them threaded throughout the internet under that search term. Our address for email was theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send physical mail, postcards, packages, locks of hair, stacks of hundreds to The Omnibus Project at 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-998. Remember, our show is listener-supported. So please consider joining our Patreon community at patreon.com/omnibusproject. There you will find a treasure trove of photos and notes, outtakes and mail, and Ken Jennings being a goofball back in the old days, and monthly addenda episodes dating into the distant, distant past, and levels of subscription with perks including exclusive merch items, many, many bonuses, early access to weekly episodes. It is more than worth your time and money to subscribe at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all of our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.